Fighting expands to more areas on the fifth day of Russia's military operation in Ukraine, with the two sides set to hold talks on the Belarus border. The EU foreign policy chief says the bloc will provide 500 million euros in lethal and non-lethal aid to Ukraine in its conflict with Russia, including warplanes. Iran says the European countries and the U.S. have yet to make political decisions on major issues in the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, Russia's military operation in Ukraine is now on its fifth day, with fighting expanding to more areas across the country. The Ukrainian government says the troops are in full control of the second largest city, Kharkiv, after a Russian attack. Russian forces have targeted a gas pipeline near the city, as well as an oil depot near the capital, Kyiv. Moscow says its forces have entirely besieged the southern Ukrainian city of Kherson and the southeastern city of Berdyansk. In Kyiv, the Ukrainian army says it's holding the line around the capital, but is fighting Russian sabotage groups that have infiltrated the city. It also says that a Russian tank company has been destroyed near Kyiv. A senior advisor to the Ukrainian president says that Russia is a losing initiative in its attack and has suffered heavy losses.
Russia has lost the initiative and is now unable to continue active hostilities. In my estimation, in the estimation of other military experts, the insane losses they have experienced and the resistance of the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian armed forces and the thwarted plans of their first 3 days of the campaign show that the further perspective of offensive action in Ukraine is futile.
Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba says that Russia's goal is to destroy his country, but he stressed that they will not fall and give up a single inch of their territory. In Russia, the defense minister says its armed forces have hit more than 1,000 Ukrainian military sites since Moscow began its military operation on Thursday. The ministry also confirmed deaths and injuries among Russian servicemen without specifying. So far, some 350 people have lost their lives in Ukraine, that according to the government there. And the UN Refugee Agency says that nearly 400,000 have fled the country. It says the number continues to rise. Russia's flagship carrier Aeroflot says it's suspending flights to Europe after the European Union closed its airspace to Russian aircraft in response to the country's military action in Ukraine. Aeroflot says that flights to European route networks are suspended as of Monday until further notice. On Sunday, several European nations, including Germany, Spain, France, and Britain, declared a ban on the Russian use of their airspace. Canada has made a similar decision. The U.S. has yet to decide whether it will close its skies to Russia. Meanwhile, the U.S. and France have called on their citizens to consider leaving Russia immediately. The European Union has announced that it will supply Ukraine with lethal weapons to fight against Russian forces, and that's while critics believe the decision contradicts how the EU has portrayed itself as a peace project. Our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes tells us more.
Sunday, the 27th of February, has been described as a major turning point for the EU. Including fighter jets, the 27-country bloc is going to send deadly military hardware to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian forces.
For the first time ever, the European Union will finance the purchase and delivery of weapons and other equipment to a country that is under attack.
The EU has always labelled itself as a peace project. Analysts are now questioning this.
They release huge funds to buy these lethal weapons from their own industries and to supply belligerent groups to continue the conflict. I think it's absolutely shocking and it's funeral of the European project as such, because it's not more a project of peace.
Another package of sanctions against Russia and Belarus were agreed by EU foreign affairs ministers on Sunday. Some Russian banks are being blocked from the SWIFT financial payment system.
This degree of disconnection is carefully calibrated in order to create the maximum damage to the financial system of Russia.
EU airspace is being closed to all Russian aircraft, and Russian media outlets, including RT, are being banned from broadcasting in the 27-nation bloc. Also on Sunday, EU Home Affairs ministers met to discuss support for member states Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania, which have witnessed flows of asylum seekers.
We have already seen more than 300,000 Ukrainians are fleeing the country, coming to the European Union.
Meanwhile, all eyes are now on the Kremlin to see how it might respond to this latest set of measures. The EU is clearly taking a calculated risk by providing deadly weapons to Ukraine. But could this lead to the crisis spiralling completely out of control? EU citizens will be hoping the risk has not been miscalculated by the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Now, President Vladimir Putin's decision to put Russia's nuclear weapons on high alert has drawn mixed reactions from Western officials. Some are playing it down as a diversion. Others are warning of a potentially ominous escalation. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says the move is part of a pattern of the Russian leader's behavior to fabricate threats justifying further aggression. The U.S. ambassador to UN says that Putin's actions are unnecessarily escalatory and totally unacceptable. A Pentagon official also warned that Putin's move could put in play forces that would make things much more dangerous in case of a miscalculation. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, meantime, said the denouncement is a distraction from what's really happening in Ukraine and the resistance that Russia is facing. Putin on Sunday cited aggressive statements by leading NATO powers and unfriendly economic actions by Western countries for his decision. Now, moving on, Iran says that a draft agreement has been prepared following negotiations in Vienna aimed at reviving the 2015 landmark accord, but the West has yet to adopt a political decision for a final deal.
There is this draft of an agreement that's prepared, so that draft needs to be studied and scrutinized carefully. There are a number of issues left. So there were certain instructions that Dr. Bavari needs to have in order to be able to negotiate with the other side. In the three, let's say, major sticking points, there are still, you know, the Western side and the U.S., they still have not adopted the political decision.
Khatibzadeh says Tehran has raised its red lines during the negotiations, the logic behind them and how those issues could be addressed. The spokesman said that Tehran will not refrain from its red lines and that sanctions removal and enrichment are still among issues that have to be resolved. He blamed Washington for the status quo and saying that the U.S. has to give concrete guarantees with regards to its commitments under the deal. Khatibzadeh said that Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal are there at the talks to come up with a more lasting agreement. He said the Islamic Republic will not do anything beyond the 2015 agreement. A political commentator Robert Fantina says that the United States is the one that violated the 2015 agreement in the first place, so it cannot impose any artificial deadline for its revival.
We have to remember that it's the United States and the European signatories who violated the agreement. The government of Iran needs to look at any new proposals, evaluate them to see how they best serve the people of Iran, and act accordingly. And if the United States wants to put artificial deadlines on the negotiations, then the United States can once again walk away from the agreement, because the government of Iran is not going to be forced into an agreement that is not beneficial to it. That's been made clear repeatedly throughout these negotiations and is continued to be made clear.
Now, the U.S. presence in Syria is illegal and represents the biggest obstacle to peace and stability there, and that according to the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Ali Shamkhani says the United States is eluding Syrian resources and attempting to dominate the country. He also said America's measures to arm, train, and direct terrorist groups are a threat to security of both Syria and the entire region. Iran's top security official expressed regret that some of Syria's neighbors are playing into the hands of the enemies. He stressed that plots can be foiled through maintaining national solidarity and the spirit of resistance. Shamkhani was speaking with Syria's National Security Bureau Chief in Tehran. Ali Mamluk hailed Iran's support for Syria and its campaign to counter terrorism and plots hatched by the U.S. and its pawns. The political activist Sarah Flanders tells us how terrorist groups are a means for the U.S. to achieve its end of wreaking havoc in other countries.
Well, U.S. policy in Syria and in country after country around the world where they want to establish a government totally under their thumb is to use and train with massive supplies of weapons and disruptive forces, terrorist groups. And this is what has absolutely been U.S. policy in Syria since 2011, to use every measure to create instability, to create massive waves of refugees and displaced people, and to do everything they can possibly do to bring ruin to the country. Syria has resisted all their plans, sought help everywhere that they could from friendly countries, but fought their own battle to maintain sovereignty. And that is important. And just to take Ali Shamkhani's statement, that this is U.S. policy. It's a completely destructive policy, regardless of where they apply it. And for sure, it's been done in a really horrendous way in Syria, but it has not succeeded because there's been real resistance.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says that Israel is the main culprit behind provoking conflicts in the region.
This is the main instigator to target our nation. The main instigator is the Zionist lobby in the world and the Israeli, the Zionist entity, which stole Palestine and stole parts of our nation. And our Arab states is on an arm of this Zionist lobby in the world. And the Zionist Jewish lobby is what moves America, it's what moves the U.S., what moves Britain, is what also moves in the West to support these stances and the objectives.
Abdel Malik al-Houthi also denounced the normalization deals between Israel and a number of Arab nations as an act of treason. He said that those Arab countries are trying to portray Tel Aviv as a friend and tarnish the image of resistance groups. But he added that Israel is using them as a tool to implement its plots in the region. Al-Houthi noted that Muslim people will foil such plots through resistance and steadfastness. He made a comment on a televised address to the Yemeni nation. Now shifting to Afghanistan, public universities across the country have reopened after being closed for some 7 months. Now female and male students have joined classes separately. Zamatullah Pakman report.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they are happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be canceled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain where the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban takeover. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Now, North Korea has confirmed having launched a missile on Sunday as part of developing a reconnaissance satellite system. Pyongyang says the test helped confirm the accuracy of high-resolution image and data transmission systems. However, the North has not elaborated on the type of the rocket it used in the test. Authorities in South Korea say it appeared to be a ballistic missile fired from an area near Pyongyang. The missile launch was the eighth this year and the first since the end of January, when North Korea fired off a record number of projectiles. Pyongyang is under criticism by some countries, including the U.S., for its missile and nuclear programs. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition from Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. My grandma's home. She has gone shopping to the bazaar. The sound you hear is the sound of a water fountain. My grandma loves Persian gardens a lot, so she has put a small fountain in a corner of the living room. You just need to close your eyes and imagine yourself in the middle of a Persian garden. Before I forget, today we are going to visit the Persian Garden of Tehran. I'm sure you'll like it. Persian gardens are the gardens which are made based on the architecture of Iran's plateau. In Persian literature, Persian garden is referred to as Bagh Sara, Pardis, or Bustan.
Persian Garden has three structures as well as a unique design. Firstly, it has been located on the pathway of water stream. Secondly, it is surrounded with tall walls. And thirdly, inside the garden, there is a summer mansion and a water pool. Persian gardens are intertwined with the history of emergence of Qanats in Iran. The first Persian gardens were created at the exit route of Qanats, which can be found in the cities of Tabas, Yazd, Gunabad, Birjand, and most desert areas. The Persian Garden of Tehran is an old garden located in Vanak neighborhood. The garden covers 3.5 hectares, with more than 2 hectares of it being green environment. This garden and its mansion belongs to a person called Mirza Hasan Khan Mostofiul Mamalek. His father was the district of Dehvanakht from Nasiruddin Shah Qajar, and after digging several qanats, made a village out of that area. Currently, this garden, while keeping its original form, has become a spectacular park in Tehran. I am now standing by the Persian Garden of Tehran. This garden has a brick-made meshed entrance. On the ceiling of the entrance, green and blue chandeliers are hanging. This great entrance is hinting us that a wonderful scenery is ahead. Let's go inside. I knew I would see such a spectacular scenery in this garden. Here, there are very old trees which date back to 150 to 250 years ago. Plane trees, cypress trees, elms, locust trees. Oh, that way there are some pomegranate and persimmon trees. And on my right, the neighboring of tall walnut trees with short berry trees has made a very beautiful paradox. And this is a water pool left from the Qajarid era. Oh, how cold the water is! Freezing! I am now standing at the end of the Persian garden. Here, there is a kushk. Kushk is a Farsi word, which is actually the summertime structure of the garden. This kushk has a library, which is suitable for book lovers to come to this calm place and read books in its hall. And in spring and summer, this garden is filled with colorful tulips. In the middle of the sidewalks of the garden, beautiful water streams have been made. Indeed, from any side of the garden which you pass, you can hear the pleasant sound of the water streams. I wish my grandma was here so she could enjoy this beautiful sound. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is now in its fourth day, with fighting expanding to more areas across the country. While Russia says so far it has hit over 1,000 Ukrainian military sites, Kiev says Moscow is losing its initiative in the attack and has suffered heavy losses. Meanwhile, EU leaders are discussing more sanctions on Russia and Belarus, and now also providing Ukraine with military assistance is on the table. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will try to find out how the situation escalated to this point, and with the Ukrainian government agreeing to hold unconditional talks with Russia, whether we can hope that a peace deal could be on the horizon. But before we begin, let's bring in our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, to get some updates from the EU. Jerome?
That's right. Yes, Gisu. Well, I'm here at the Council of the EU in Brussels, where the Home Affairs Ministers have been meeting to discuss plans to try and take in asylum seekers coming from Ukraine. Of course, they're mainly going into Poland, Slovakia, Romania and Hungary. And these EU countries, the governments there are traditionally well known to being anti-refugees. So it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that pans out. But also happening at the moment is a virtual online meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers. And they are rubber stamping new proposals put forward by Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the Commission, earlier. It talks about, you know, banning Russia Today and Sputnik, so media outlets in Russia, banning them here in the EU. Also, more or less banning the aviation industry. It'll be a no-fly zone for the Russian aircraft over the EU, the entire EU. They cannot land or take off. Also, some of the major banks are being taken out of the SWIFT payment transaction system. But most importantly, as you mentioned in the introduction, the EU is officially, for the first time as a 27-nation bloc, actually going to finance the funding of deadly weapons into a conflict into Ukraine. So the big question there is, how might Russia react? Could this spiral out of control altogether? Because in fairness, these really are the hardest sanctions ever put forward by the EU. And when you add on to that the sort of the direct military intervention from the European Union itself as a whole, and the United States as well, and the UK, obviously citizens are watching out to see how this might escalate or how it might pan out.
Thank you very much, Jerome. And that, of course, is one of the questions that we will have our guests respond to. Now, to continue this discussion, we are joined by Mr. Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, joining us live from Hamilton. And also, we have with us Alicia Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who is joining us live from Brussels. Now, in order to begin our discussion, we will start with Mr. Alicia Magnier, who is joining us. Alicia, Russia has said that the main reason for this military operation is NATO's eastward expansion and its security concerns. So we could safely say that NATO is at least partly to blame for where we are right now. Why is the EU aggravating the situation by getting involved militarily?
Well, first of all, yes, it is the presence of NATO all along the Russian borders, and particularly in most of the former Soviet Union countries, and at the exception of Ukraine and Georgia, of course. And because NATO said that it has looked into the acceptance of the candidateship of Ukraine and Georgia, this is where the Russian President Vladimir Putin is reacting today and is saying, you cannot accept the membership of Ukraine and Georgia or enable Ukraine to become a nuclear power country because it presents a serious danger to the national security of my country. And in 1990, when during the perestroika, U.S. Secretary James Baker promised President Mikhail Gorbachev that NATO will not move an inch from its current position in 1990 and will not move into the former Soviet Republic. In 1993, U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher did exactly the same with President Boris Yeltsin, who sent a letter to Bill Clinton at that time saying that NATO and Russia should establish a friendly relationship. However, NATO should not move in the former Soviet Republic. And Christopher promised President Yeltsin that NATO will not do that. So, but however, we saw in 1999 that these verbal promises, not written promises, but verbal promises that were shown by the U.S. National Security Archive and by the memoir of Secretary Christopher in his book, and also in other sources within the U.S. administration at that time, who lengthily wrote about it, including the German Chancellor Helmut Kohl at that time. They all said that this is what was a verbal promise. Now, Russia was too weak to maintain, to react to the Americans when they broke their promises, which is something that the world is used to, because we've seen the Americans breaking their promises, even written agreement, and I call upon only the JCPOA in 2018 by President Donald Trump, and did not respect the agreement with Russia. And now Russia has become much stronger, is ready for the sanction, is ready to claim its right, and is ready to tell to the Americans, you cannot install strategic missiles that can carry nuclear warhead on the borders of Russia and the former Soviet Union that need only a few minutes to reach Moscow or to any other nearby city close to the border. So this is the reaction of President Putin by walking into Ukraine. And he's not saying that he wants to remove President Zelensky. He's saying, I want an agreement and I want a document that states that Ukraine will remain neutral, exactly like Finland agreement in 1953. He wants all the former Soviet Union to sign the same agreement because he can see that NATO is behaving in an aggressive way, expanding its control and its presence along the borders with Russia, and installing nuclear missile in every country that is moving in. This is what this is about. We see the consequences of what President Putin is doing, but we look at the origin of the whole problem.
Exactly. So as you mentioned so yourself, and let's bring in Mr. Ken Stone to continue this right now. As Alicia mentioned, the U.S. and NATO clearly disregarded Russia's security concern, and they, in a way, paved the way for the situation we are in right now. So at this point, we don't see any efforts from their part to de-escalate the situation. Is there anything that they find in their best interest in what's going on right now? Were they planning for this to happen?
Indeed, they were planning for this to happen. And by this, I mean the eastward expansion of NATO right up to Russia's borders. Your other guest, Monsieur Magnier, explained the history here very well, and I won't try and elaborate on it. But clearly the plan is and remains to encircle Russia and to push NATO right up to the borders of Russia in every space along the border where they can. And the purpose of this is to augment U.S. hegemony over the entire European continent. Once they get up to the borders of Russia, of course, I feel that they would try and do exactly what they tried to do in Syria and in Libya, Iraq, many other countries, and that is to balkanize the what's left of Russia, and they would turn it into small nationalist governments that would be too weak to resist the U.S. And this is exactly what happened when NATO attacked and bombed Yugoslavia in 1999, 72 days of bombing, 30,000 bombs, and they destroyed the country of Yugoslavia, which was the only success story of the First World War. And that's their plan for Russia. So the U.S. was planning this, but now Mr. Putin has foiled their plan. He has drawn the line. He drew a red line at Ukraine, and now he is going to insist that Ukraine be independent, be neutral rather, and that it be demilitarized and denazified. And these were all, this could have been settled peacefully when Russia came with proposals on December 21st, 2021, by sending draft treaties to the U.S. and NATO asking for reasonable security guarantees for Russia, because Russia understands that security is indivisible and you can't have security for one country at the expense of another. So they asked for reasonable security guarantees, and one of them was that Ukraine become neutral and they get a ironclad guarantee that it would never join NATO. This was a very reasonable proposition, but the U.S. and NATO just cast aside their demands. And then a few days later, Mr. Zelensky said that he was no longer interested in the Minsk protocols, which he was required to negotiate with the breakaway republics and to restore their language and cultural rights and their former autonomy that they lost when the U.S. staged a coup in 2014 and stole democracy from Ukraine and instead brought in a junta riddled with Nazi parties, and I mean real Nazi parties, the same ones that allied with Hitler in World War II, and with Nazi elements in its police and in its army. So this is the result of 30 years of westward aggressive expansion by NATO, which is not a defensive alliance. It's an offensive alliance of the United States. It was set up by the Prime Minister of Canada at his insistence in 1949, that was Lester Pearson. It was to protect the North Atlantic countries from the alleged threat of communism. Well, when the Soviet Union dissolved itself in 1991, NATO should have dissolved itself as well. And it didn't. And this is what we're stuck with today. An aggressive military alliance pushing toward the heart of Russia stopped at the borders of Ukraine by Mr. Putin and the Russian Federation.
And still making aggressive statements, according to Mr. Putin, who has ordered Russia's nuclear deterrent forces on alert in response to those aggressive statements by NATO. So let's bring in Mr. Mann here. What could this implicate, this nuclear deterrent forces on alert?
Well, it's extremely serious, because when we hear all the European countries saying that we are going to send defensive and offensive weapons to Ukraine, and we hear for the first time the president of the European Commission saying that we are thinking of supporting a very large credit for Ukraine to buy weapons and supply it with the necessary weapons. This is a kind of a declaration of war from the side of Europe against Russia. However, we know here in Europe that the Europeans consider Russia as a partner. 40% of their gas comes from Russia. There is a very strong economic and financial relationship between Russia and Europe. There are 4,000 companies, European companies, working in Russia, of which at least 450 only French companies are working in Russia. And Europe would freeze without the Russian gas. The Americans, the Qatari, Algeria, Azerbaijan, nobody can replace the Russian gas, particularly at this time of the year, and even for at least the next year. Therefore, all these moves that are registered by Europe are not European decisions. They are NATO-driven. They are supported by the U.S. It is the U.S. that is dictating its policy on Europe and pushing Europe into conflict. And this has started in 2018, when the French President Emmanuel Macron said, we want the European army to defend ourselves from all the threats that Europe can face, including the one that comes from the United States. So NATO is saying, we are the army of Europe. We are the army that you need. However, it is establishing nuclear power, nuclear missile on the continent to face Russia when Russia is not the enemy. And in case of nuclear war between the United States and Russia, the first missile will be launched from the continent, not from the United States. And this is what is all about it. It is for the Americans to make sure that the Russian cannot have the possibility to intercept these missiles and to react in case of nuclear war. So by installing nuclear missiles in Ukraine or enabling Ukraine to become a nuclear power, Russia will be completely hopeless, and these nuclear missiles will reach Russia in no time without the possibility to defend itself in case of nuclear war between the West and Russia, or particularly the U.S. and Russia. So the whole thinking is orientated toward the war, and not toward prosperity, not toward supporting the economy. And we hear Biden saying he's asking the Congress for $6.5 billion to offer for the refugees that are coming from Ukraine and to support Ukraine military apparatus. We never hear him saying we are going to offer 6.5 billion for the American people or for the poor people in Asia or in Africa or in the Middle East or wherever for humanitarian objective. It's only for war and for immigrant or for the immigration and the exodus of European citizens coming from either the former Yugoslavia and now from Ukraine coming toward Europe or to any other places. So why triggering all that from the first beginning and not give Russia this paper where you guarantee that there is no threat against its security? And this is it. And we end all this tension and this unnecessary war in Ukraine.
Exactly. And now the Ukrainian president has agreed to meet with Russians without preconditions, that is. So, Mr. Stone, could we be hopeful that this might lead to a peace deal?
Yes, I think so. I think that it would be wise for Mr. Zelensky to end the resistance by Ukrainian forces, which is hopeless anyway, because the Russian armed forces have a huge military superiority and have already knocked out most of Ukraine's ability to resist. So continuing this war, well, put it the other way, finding a peace deal would save a lot of lives and it would save a lot of damage to civilian infrastructure. But we have to keep in mind what it is that a peace deal must have as its basis. And I know that the Russian government will take nothing less than a change in the status of the Ukrainian government to one that is neutral. And one that is a country that is demilitarized and denazified. So I'm not sure if Mr. Zelensky will agree to that or can agree to that. He was the peace candidate in the election in Ukraine a couple of years later. He promised to settle the dispute in the Donbass, and he didn't. He entered negotiations through the Minsk protocols, but in the last few weeks he said he gave up on the Minsk protocols, and so the war continued, provoking this situation. He also was elected to bring peace and good relations between Ukraine and Russia. And he failed to do that as well, because he continued to accept the actual gradual infiltration of NATO into Ukraine. He accepted arms from Canada, money from Canada. I'm just saying Canada right now. He accepted military trainers. He accepted warships from Canada and the Black Sea. This is just Canada. And a special forces station there from Canada. So that doesn't include from the U.S. and other countries of NATO and the European Union. So it was a progressive NATOification of Ukraine that Mr. Zelensky was presiding over. And if there's going to be a peace deal, all of that will have to be reversed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stone. And Mr. Manier, the final question, we're running out of time, so if you could please wrap it up very quickly. China has been backing Russia. Can we expect an alliance to form here? Are we looking at a new world order, basically?
New world order if President Putin ends this war very quickly. Now, we know that today there is a Russian and Ukrainian delegation that went to Belarusia to start the negotiation. That's a good step. We don't think that this is going to succeed from the first meeting. We think that there are many meetings that are required, and the Ukrainians are negotiating under the fire. However, if Mr. Putin manages to win this war very quickly and end it without a lot of losses, then there is a new order, and the part of the world that is looking for an alternative to the US hegemony will turn against Russia and will be supported by Russia.
Well, thank you very much. And quickly, Mr. Stone, your opinion on this? Are we looking at a new world order?
Well, I think actually it's the end of the US world order, the world order where the US was a unipolar hegemon, and there was no opposition to it. And that occurred since in 1991, when the former Soviet Union disbanded itself. What I think is that what we're going to see now is not necessarily a formal alliance between Russia and China, but an understanding that they need to stand together against the aggressive completely illegal expansion of NATO, not just in Europe. It's all over the world. It's in Africa. It's in Latin America. It's in Asia. So I think that we are looking at a change in the balance of power in the world.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ken Stone, from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War out of Hamilton, and also Mr. Elijah Manier, a journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts with us. And thanks for following this edition of The Spotlight.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
While the U.S. president refuses to condition military aid, the Zionist regime has toppled more than twice as many Palestinian structures in the West Bank than it had by this point in Trump's term. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Austin Allman Ryder. This article is titled, Zionist regime surpasses 1,000 demolitions in the occupied West Bank since Joe Biden took office. Stay tuned for more. The rate of the Zionist regime's destruction of Palestinian-owned properties in the occupied West Bank is accelerating at a rapid pace under U.S. President Joe Biden and the Zionist regime's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, according to data from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Recently, the UN's tally of demolitions carried out since Biden's inauguration eclipsed 1,000. In the 13 months since Biden took office, over 1,300 Palestinians, a majority of whom are children, have been displaced by the demolitions tallied by the UN, which counts each permanent closure or destruction of a residential or commercial property or key piece of infrastructure. At a similar point in President Donald Trump's tenure, on a former Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli officials had carried out the demolition of 379 structures that displaced nearly 600 Palestinians, less than half the toll overseen by Biden and Bennett so far. According to Diana Boutou, a Palestinian-Canadian lawyer and scholar at the Institute for Middle East Understanding, Bennett is ramping up these demolitions as a display of strength in hopes of stamping out any remaining hope that Palestinians might one day achieve self-determination. She told Intercept, "Bennett's making it clear that this is where the future of Israeli-Palestinian relationship lies. The future lies in the Palestinians being cordoned off into these tiny little ghettos. And all the land surrounding these ghettos will slowly be taken, be stolen for Israeli settlements." Experts say the accelerating pace of the Zionist regime's demolitions is a direct result of Biden's refusal to pressure Bennett over Palestinian rights. The United States has considerable leverage over the Zionist regime, they point out, and Biden could wield it to end the Zionist regime's aggressive expansionism, potentially within the course of a single conversation. Bhutto said, "I don't think it takes more than for him to pick up the phone and actually threaten Bennett." In the 2021 calendar year, the Zionist regime's enforced demolitions of Palestinian-owned structures surged to 907, the second highest level on record, surpassed only by the 1,094 demolitions that were carried out under President Barack Obama in 2016, while Americans were distracted by an acrimonious presidential election. Over 145 demolitions have already occurred in 2022, putting Biden and Bennett on track for another record. And experts say these figures are likely an undercount, given that some events take time to be reported or are never reported at all. The increase joins the resurgence of brazen assassinations in marking a rapid escalation in the Zionist regime's expansionism and ethnic cleansing in the occupied West Bank, and they both add texture to the ongoing backlash to decisions by leading international human rights organizations to explicitly label the Zionist regime's ongoing subjugation of Palestinians as apartheid. While proponents of Palestinian rights have been using the term to describe Israeli oppression for decades, its adoption last year by two influential international organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, has renewed attention on the atrocities committed by the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime's authorities often use discriminatory local permitting rules to justify the demolitions of Palestinian structures. Among other inequities, these rules foreclose thousands of buildings erected by Palestinians who were unable to acquire a permit from ever securing proper licensing, with few exceptions. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime's structures regularly receive retroactive permits. The disparate application of permit laws has long been a key tool of the Zionist regime in enforcement of its multi-tiered system of political rights, as Amnesty International's recent report recounts at length. While the Biden administration made public calls for the demolitions to cease in the last year, Activists say the president's refusal to apply meaningful pressure to the Zionist regime undermines his public opposition to its actions.